Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Mark Dubowitz. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. So everyone knows that Israel is engaged in a war in Gaza. What most people don't know is that this isn't actually a war on Gaza, but actually on a country 1,500 miles away. This is a war on the Iranian regime. Confused? Mark Dubowitz, CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, is an expert on Iran and has been advising the White House all the way back to the W. Bush administration. And one thing you need to know, if nothing else, Khamenei's Iran and IRGC pose an existential threat not only to the Jewish state, but to the entire Western world. From their nuclear aspirations to their terror proxy army, if all eyes aren't on Iran, they should be. Mark Dubowitz is the chief executive of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a Washington, D.C.-based nonpartisan policy institute, and a leading expert on Iran's nuclear program and global threat networks. He's the host of the Iran Breakdown podcast and contributes to FDD's China program, drawing on his background in China studies and private sector experience in the Indo-Pacific. Sanctioned by both Iran and Russia for his work, Dubowitz has been recognized for his influential role in shaping U.S. policy, with the New York Times calling his campaign against the Iran nuclear deal among the most consequential by any D.C. think tank leader. He has advised multiple U.S. administrations across party lines, testified before Congress, and authored numerous studies on economic state sanctions and nuclear issues. A former venture capitalist, with degrees from Johns Hopkins and the University of Toronto, he has lived in Washington, D.C. since 2003. Mark, thank you so much for joining us, and tremendous mazel tov on being sanctioned by both Iran and Russia.
Thanks, Shauna. First of all, it's great to be on. Thank you so much for having me and for doing this. And yeah, I mean, my mother wanted me to be a doctor, and I ended up being sanctioned by Iran and Russia. So it's I've disappointed my parents, but it's in some respects a badge of honor. In some respects, you know, it's a threat from the leading state sponsor of terrorism. So one has to always be careful.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that we all went to school. We were supposed to be either lawyers or doctors. So lawyer. Oh, right. Yoga instructor. So I know how that goes. So to start this conversation, I just want to frame this a little bit. Can you tell us a bit about FDD and its mission?
Yeah, so we're a Washington think tank. We were actually conceived of 2 weeks before 9/11 by the late, great Jean Kirkpatrick, who was Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the UN. She was a Democrat across the floor to work for Reagan. And Jean pulled together a group of people. And she said, you know, the terrorism being directed against Israel in the 1990s and the attacks, the Al-Qaeda attacks against America in our embassies in Africa, USS Cole, indeed dating back to the first World Trade Center bombing, that those attacks that were being inspired by radical Islamist jihadists would one day come to America 2 weeks before 9/11. And she said, no one's really paying attention to this. No one's connecting the dots. Everybody's taking this kind of holiday from history after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And we need a new policy institute that exclusively focused on this. And everybody said, yeah, good idea. Let's talk about it. 2 weeks later, 9/11 happened. And for Gina, it was very clear that the terrorism being directed at, against Israel as the little Satan, eventually the radical Islamists would come after the great Satan. And the radical Islamists are both on the Sunni and on the Shiite side of the street. Al-Qaeda as a Sunni jihadist organization and the Islamic Republic of Iran as a Shiite jihadist organization clearly have been targeting not only the United States, but Israel and other allies for many years. So we set up FDD. We opened our doors shortly after. And we've been in business for many years. We've got over 100 people working on these issues. And we're a think tank, we're an action tank. We like to say we do damage to the enemies of America and other free nations. And we're not happy unless we're actually having an impact, doing damage. But of course, our enemies notice that. And as a result, I and some of my colleagues have been sanctioned by Iran and Russia and China, blacklisted by Turkey, blacklisted by Qatar. So we've been collecting these badges of honor for over 20 years.
Wow. It is amazing. I didn't realize that was right before 9/11. It's amazing how short-term American memory has proven to be, especially vis-a-vis where we are today. I really want to focus primarily on the Iranian-Israeli relationship, of course, in light of the ongoing nuclear talks. And I'd like to start just with a little bit of historical background, because what I think most people will be astounded to learn, given today's explosive rivalry, is that Iran and Israel actually had pretty warm relations under the Shah, including diplomatic ties, economic cooperation, and yes, as hard as it is to believe, even security and military cooperation. Can you explain how and why did that all change when the Ayatollah came to power?
Yeah, I mean it's really important to understand that it dates back even further than the Shah. I mean, this goes back to Cyrus the Great, who was mentioned in the Hebrew Bible as really a hero of the Jewish people because he returned the Jews back to Jerusalem. And many people talk about the Abraham Accords. I think there are many Iranians and many Israelis who talk about the Cyrus Accords, that one day there will be peace between Iran, a free Iran, and Israel. And it's always interesting. I'm sure you've been at these pro-Israel rallies in Canada or the US, United States, around Europe. Obviously, a lot of pro-Israel Jews and Christians there, but also a lot of Iranians who understand the nature of the enemy. I mean, they understand Hamas, they understand Hezbollah, because they understand their own brutal regime. And those who are old enough to remember the days under the Shah, which, as you've described, were much warmer between the Shah's Iran and between Israel, with diplomatic ties, not an Israeli embassy, as I recall, but certainly free flow of Israelis and Iranians, business, military, security, intel cooperation, but also a great cultural affinity between these two people. And I, on my podcast, Iran Breakdown, have really tried to make a point of bringing on Iranians to talk about the overall relationship with the United States, but also with Israel. And it's always so clear to me that there is not only a great cultural affinity, but these Iranians really recognize that the Islamic Republic of Iran, as distinct from Iran, right? This is not only an American enemy, it's not only an Israeli enemy, but at the end of the day, 80% of Iranians despise this regime and want to see it go and recognize that a free Iran would not only return to the days of a warm relationship under the Shah. I think those relationships would even be more expansive and deeper and more profound than even it was in the 1970s.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get to that towards the end of the conversation, because I think that in the order of things, first there's going to be nuclear talks, then we could consider the Cyrus Accords. But this is definitely something I want to get more into later on in this conversation. So, Mark, why is destroying Israel so important to the IRGC?
Well, the Islamic Revolution, when it occurred in 1979, and it totally upended not only the Iran-Israel relationship, but the U.S.-Israel, a U.S.-Iran relationship. This was a revolutionary movement, a revolutionary regime, and it was really built on some fundamental pillars. Clearly, it was built on the pillar of Islamism, and turning this into a radical theocracy. It was built on the hatred of the United States, the Great Satan. It's actually built on the hatred of the UK, which they also saw as maybe the medium-sized Satan, and then hatred of Israel, which was the little Satan. By the way, the other pillars of the Islamic Revolution were also the hijab, the forced enslavement of Iranian women under these draconian Islamist dress codes, and really taking this extraordinary population of Iranian women who really are formidable and incredible. We can talk about some of the many expressions of that that we've seen in recent years, and really putting them under a hijab, covering their hair, not allowing them to go to, soccer matches, and really creating a system of gender apartheid that has really enslaved the woman of Iran. That hijab is a fundamental pillar of the Islamic State, the Islamic Republic, as much as the hatred of Israel, the hatred of America, and the draconian theocratic codes of the Islamist Revolution and Republic. Why the hatred of Israel? I think, I think Khomeini himself, I mean, was profoundly anti-Semitic. I mean, we hear a lot about the Iranian Jewish community and that they're well protected. Well, the reality is number one, most of the Iranian Jews left because they were facing significant threats and discrimination. Those who remained, a number of them were executed as, quote, spies for Israel, which was sent shockwaves to the Iranian Jewish community. And Khomeini, was a virulent anti-Semite. And he also saw that Israel itself, as the Jewish state, or the Zionist entity, as they would call it, needed to be destroyed. And that was sort of fundamental to the mission and the goals of the Islamic Republic. And it was also a way of rallying the Muslim world, because for him, those Sunni Sunni the Sunni Saudis who were skiing in Stade, Switzerland, and drinking whiskey with their infidel buddies did not have the credibility to be the guardians of the two mosques. They were infidels, just like their infidel buddies. And that was really the Islamic Republic, the first Islamist state that really should rule the Middle East and rule the Muslim world. And certainly targeting Israel was a way to rally Muslims in the Middle East and around the world around this revolutionary mission. So he had both the core ideology of hatred of Israel, the anti-Semitic inclinations, but also instrumentalizing that in order to take over the Muslim Middle East and the Muslim world.
Makes sense. Israel being the only freckle of non-Islamism or Arab ism in the entire Middle East, as well as being as close to American Western civilization as by far any country in the nation. So in the nation, in
There
the
was one
area.
other, yeah, one other thing which is important to remember. I mean, 20% of Israel's population is Arab. The
Right.
vast majority of them are Muslim, and they live in a free nation. They live in a democracy. And so, this is a great insult and a great threat to the Islamic Republic and to Khomeini and then his successor, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, because here were Muslims living free, and yet the Muslims in Iran were living under this brutal regime. And so again, yes, this freckle of Western democracy and pro-American free market civilization, it was one thing, but the other thing was free Muslims living in
Yeah.
Israel. That was a, in a sense, an existential threat to the fundamental ideology of the Islamic Republic.
Sure. And the handful of Jews who remain in Iran live there as dhimmis, as second-class citizens. So it's so far from a parallel. So let's talk about Iran's proxy system. Can you explain how it works and like what is the strategy behind it vis-a-vis, let's talk about focusing right now on Israel specifically, unless you really want to get into America.
Definitely always want to get into America because
Okay, you could get into
I'm an
America.
American and I live in America. I think it is
Okay, do it
important to
all.
understand. I do think it's important to understand that the war, first of all, it's not an Israeli war on Iran, right? It's an Islamic Republic war on Israel, on Western civilization, and fundamentally on America. I mean, they're building nuclear weapons to threaten Israel, to threaten the Saudis, the Emiratis, US forces in the Middle East, but they're also building intercontinental ballistic missiles that are nuclear tipped that only have one address, and that's the United States of America, and by the way, Europe as well. And so it's really always important in terms of framing to understand that the threat is really a threat to the United States, to Western civilization, and yes, of course, to Israel. I think it's always very important to emphasize that. And I think it also helps understand their proxy strategy. I mean, their proxy strategy was essentially a way to expand their influence, threaten their neighbors, and defend the homeland on the cheap. I mean, they had gone through, this brutal Iran-Iraq war, which cost over 1 million lives on both sides. They'd faced, missiles raining down on their cities from Saddam. And their security doctrine was one of, we will defend our sovereignty by also going on the offense. And we'll go on the offense in order to expand the revolution, but we'll do it on the cheap in the sense that we'll do it through proxies. And proxies are useful because, number one, it's not Iranians who are going to be dying. It's going to be Lebanese, Syrians, Pakistanis, Afghans, Palestinians. Again, anybody they were willing to kind of throw into the war and was willing to fight for them. Also, it was cheap, right? It wasn't expensive like building up a massive military and buying billions of dollars worth of fighter jets and attack helicopters and nuclear submarines. First of all, they didn't have the money. Second, they were under military sanctions and an embargo. And third is they also wanted deniability. So it was always great to have these proxies who were going to attack US troops, slaughter Middle Easterners and attack Israel. And they could just say, well, that was Hezbollah, that was Hamas, that was Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Well, that was the Iraqi Shiite militias, well, the Houthis in Yemen. That's not us. Those are these, local actors. And by the way, by having local actors, it was also smart because those local actors knew the country, knew the language. They spoke Arabic, not Persian, and they could infiltrate those societies because they were natives. And as a result, they were much more successful in being able to take over these countries and expand the ambit of Iranian power and ultimately build a ring of fire around Israel, which they did very successfully before October 7th, as well as their ultimate mission, which is to drive U.S. forces and the United States out of the Middle East. I mean, that is their overall ambition. You first got to drive the US out of the Middle East, and then you go in for the kill shot and you take out Israel, and then you build nuclear weapons, and now you can threaten the United States. So that's sort of the strategy, and the proxies were a central pillar in that strategy.
Amazing. Okay. So mostly I want to focus on nuclear talks today, but could we stick with Gaza for a moment, who is one of the local actors? Right now, Israel has actually agreed to the terms of another Witkoff hostage exchange ceasefire deal, which quite honestly would be a huge tactical setback, but would also free Israeli assets to focus on attacking Iran. Is there a chance that as a proxy of Iran, Hamas continues to reject all ceasefire agreements in an effort to keep Israel occupied, no pun intended, and therefore limited in its ability to strike Iran? Is Iran behind Hamas's refusals? Because overall, the Witkoff proposal is really in their favor.
Yeah, I think it's always really important to understand to kind of zoom out, and you're right to zoom out on this question, because yes, Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the sort of two main actors in Gaza, are Palestinian Islamic Jihad is a proxy. It is, armed, financed, controlled, and directed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Hamas is more complicated. Again, it's a Sunni actor. It's not Shiite. It's Palestinian. It's not Persian. It has local conditions and constraints. But it has, yes, been financed, armed, trained, and weaponized by the Revolutionary Guards and used as one of the key elements in this ring of fire over multiple years in order to threaten Israel. And Khamenei has a very well understood, or not well understood, but I think well-conceived strategy. His strategy is, I am going to wear down the Israelis. I'm going to get them into a grinding war of attrition. I am going to use my proxies to continue to launch terrorist attacks and missiles and drones and rockets at Israel. I'm going to pull Israel into these grinding wars. And I'm going to do that in Gaza. I'm going to do that in Lebanon. I'm going to do that in Judea and Samaria. I'm going to build this in Syria. I'm going to arm the Houthis so they continue to fire on Israel, which is a form not just of military warfare, but of economic warfare. I'm going to shut down the airport. I'm going to shut down the flights. I'm going to wage this grinding war of attrition against the Israelis. I'm going to cause significant casualties. I'm going to make Israel an intolerable place to live. The best and the brightest who have multiple passports and transferable skills in the tech sector and people who can actually go are going to leave because they're tired of the pain and the tension and the war. And it's going to leave behind this rump of Israelis who don't have that option to leave. But at the end of the day, we will go in on multiple fronts, and these people will try to defend themselves, but they will be limited in their ability. And ultimately, then we'll go in for the kill shot. And the kill shot will be the destruction of Israel. And it may not be destruction of Israel by using nuclear weapons. It may just be using conventional firepower in order to wear down the country, get rid of its most talented people, make it an intolerable place to live, and then create enough death and destruction, and then we march on Jerusalem. So that's kind of Khamenei's plan. And it's sort of the plan that the North Korean dictator has as well, right? I mean, he holds South Korea and Seoul hostage with conventional weapons, by the way, backed up by nuclear weapons. He has limited the South Korean and US military options. He could destroy Seoul in a week. And now he's kind of immunized against US or South Korean or Japanese military attack because we would lose South Korea if there was any kind of conflict. And so Khamenei wants to turn Tel Aviv into Seoul. It's the same kind of strategy. And he has been very successful until recently in doing exactly that. We've got to be careful. Those who care about Israel, and those who are advising Israelis, don't walk into his trap. Because if you continue to fight this grinding war in Gaza against Hamas and its remnants, then it'll pull energy, resources. Your troops are tired. They're fighting fight for 500, 600 days. They're going back, the reserves. It's draining your economy. Plus, he's going to light up Judea and Samaria as he's been doing. Lebanon, Syria, and he's just going to keep the Houthis are going to be firing missiles. He's going to keep lighting up multiple fronts, and it'll just exhaust you. Meanwhile, as he has launched the weapon of mass distraction, he's going to advance the weapon of mass destruction, which is his nuclear program. That has been his strategy to date. And I think in some respects, October 7th, even though it was devastating for Israel, it's given the Israelis the opportunity to start to reverse their strategy and to start to undermine Khamenei's ring of fire attrition strategy. But at some point, the law of diminishing returns will kick in Gaza. I think it's kicked in already. And I think at that point, Israel needs to reach a ceasefire, get as many of the hostages back. And we can talk about other steps the Israelis need to take, but essentially start to wind down Gaza so they've got the energy, the resources, and the focus to look at these other multiple fronts, including this expanding nuclear program.
As Rabbi Wolpe would say, Jews prefer their clouds without the silver lining. That was intense.
No, but there is a silver lining, and
I
I
know.
want to
Yes, it
emphasize
means.
that the silver lining is, first of all, October 7th could have been far worse than it was. That's what Khamenei was planning with the Revolutionary Guards. We can talk about what the plan was. But the second thing is, I think it's really important to understand Khamenei's strategy so that we don't keep walking into his traps. And I worry, as I think you can infer from my comments, that I worry the Israelis in Gaza are now run the risk of walking into a Khamenei trap. Which is why I think let's wind down the war, ceasefire, get the hostages back, put in arrangements where the IDF can continue to move in and out of Gaza the way they move in and out of Lebanon right now, and in and out of Judea and Samaria. Keep killing Hamas terrorists, keep taking out military infrastructure, but start to look for some kind of political solution the way that we have in Lebanon, so that the Israeli defense forces are not stuck in there in the morass of Gaza, and therefore we don't have the ability and the resources and the time and the focus to deal with these other fronts and to deal with this expanding nuclear program.
Okay. I actually don't want to focus too much on Gaza because I've done about 50 episodes on Gaza and I think exactly none on Iran. So I'm gonna pivot back to Iran. But of course, Gaza is always at the forefront in the background, however you look at it. So right now, like negotiations or even pending war with Iran, and I'm talking about direct, like full on attacks by Israel seem to be like the crescendo of 20 months of war in the Middle East. Do you think we would have come to this point had October 7th never happened?
Well, I think eventually we would have come to this point because that, again, that's Khamenei's strategy. What I'm trying to do is to sort of inject into this conversation, because I think you're right. There's so many conversations about Gaza. There are some conversations about Lebanon. We, by the way, there are very few conversations about what's going on in Judea and Samaria over the past couple of years. Obviously now conversations about Yemen. But I think the important thing to always understand is, how does the Supreme Leader see it? How's he moving the pieces on the chessboard? And if he's playing three-dimensional chess and we're playing checkers, he wins, we lose. If we
Right.
understand his strategy and we adapt to it and we start to take the offensive, then I think we have a better chance of winning. I think we were going to come to this because at some point there was going to be an invasion of Israel from multiple fronts, as I described, and Israel was going to be under attack. And Iran was going to be raining missiles and rockets down on Israel, either through its proxies and or directly. Thank God Israel can now actually be in a position, in a much stronger position than it otherwise would have been in if that had occurred. So we were going to come to it anyway, but now that we're at it, I think the real question is, how does Israel flip the script on Khamenei, and how does Israel take advantage of these whatever 600 days of war to really begin to undermine, to weaken him, and ultimately, if history smiles on us, to topple the Islamic Republic, create the free Iran we talked about earlier in the podcast, and get rid of what is ultimately a strategic and existential threat, and have a peace agreement, the Cyrus Accords, with a free Iran, and a much better Middle East.
Sure. And while Iran is at its weakest, I think it would be safe to argue that Israel's finding itself at its strongest point ever. On top of that, they've taken out most of Iran's air defenses and missile production. And the regime is choking financially under pretty crippling sanctions, including brand new ones on 10 individuals and 27 Iran-affiliated entities just today. I have a question that it just boggles my mind. Why is the US negotiating with Iran instead of dictating terms?
Yeah. So a couple of things. First of all, I think Israel is in a much stronger position militarily. I worry that Israel is not in a strong position diplomatically and politically.
Yes.
I worry when, as I talked about, the law of diminishing returns kicking in. It's clear to me that, the diplomatic offensive, the political warfare campaign against Israel is only intensifying with Canada and France, UK, and maybe Germany, maybe not, but certainly other European countries, Latin American countries, starting to look at things like sanctions and military embargoes. And certainly within the United States here, there's a strong element of the Democratic Party. There's an increasing element of the Republican Party on the isolationist side, where politically Israel is in a more fragile position. And so one can always celebrate the military achievements, and one should, but we have to look more broadly at where Israel is going politically and make sure that this trajectory, which I'm very concerned about, doesn't end up with Israel isolated under sanctions, facing political and economic warfare, which would be ironic and sad given the fact that it should be is the Islamic Republic of Iran isolated under political and economic pressure. Why is the United States not dictating terms? Because US presidents repeatedly, sometimes for good reason, believe that they can get more at the negotiating table in constraining Iran's nuclear program than they can get by bombing Iran. And I think the Trump administration, like the Biden and Obama and Bush administrations, I've been through all of them, believe that with Iran weak, this is the time to cast the shadow of power across the negotiating table, leverage that to get a deal that strips Iran of its key nuclear infrastructure and therefore prevents Iran from developing nuclear weapons.
Okay, I'm gonna take a little bit of a detour here, and I'm not sure how much you study Islamic fundamentalism versus like the IRGC. But one thing that I've noticed pretty strongly, actually, is that as a Jewish person, the fundamentalist Jews right now are talking about the coming of the Mashiach, right, of the Jewish Messiah. The fundamentalist Christians are talking nonstop about the second coming of Jesus. And in the Muslim fundamentalists are talking about the 12th Imam. Now, if we accept that these are probably all like versions of the same exact thing, just with a different name, the world is feeling pretty cataclysmic or apocalyptic right now. Do you think that like the 12th Imam has a hand in these negotiations?
I don't know if he has. I know that the theology that you to which you refer certainly has permeated the Iranian political and security establishment. I mean, I think Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, was a believer in the hidden Imam, the hidden Mahdi, and I think that that sort of more apocalyptic view of Islam is something that has gotten more popular within the regime and within the revolutionary elite. It is worth saying that the vast majority of Iranians reject that. In fact, the vast majority of Iranians today are rejecting Islam. I mean, the mosques are empty and the
Really?
clerics are belittled and assaulted on the streets, and Iranians are secularizing in great numbers. A number of them are converting to Christianity or embracing the Baha'i faith, which is brutally repressed inside Iran. So I think Iran is a good example of a country where, because it is based on a theology, and that theology has been shoved down the throats of Iranians since 1979, they are rejecting it in massive numbers. But that kind of a apocalyptic view is something that is held by senior members of the Revolutionary Guards and the security establishment. All the way up to the most influential clerics, and it's a dangerous view, because if you hold that view and you think that at the end of the day, in order to usher in the coming of the hidden imam, you have to create the situation of Armageddon for that. Well, Armageddon is a massive war in the Middle East, perhaps a nuclear exchange, and then only then will you usher that in. When you hold that view, it's pretty hard to deter people. Through conventional deterrence mechanisms to and constrain them from not using nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Okay, back to Earth. So thank you for enlightening me on that. So last week's IAEA report confirmed what we already knew. Iran has been dragging its feet through these talks while simultaneously accelerating its rush to nuclear breakout. The report was dire enough for Netanyahu to give an incredibly rare emergency speech on Shabbat. Now, I'm not saying this is the case, but even if we were to assume that Trump couldn't care less about the fate of Israel, which a lot of people argue I'm not going to, as you mentioned, Iran is developing ICBMs with the express intent, really, of one day destroying America. Isn't that enough reason for Trump to insist on complete dismantlement? Because we're hearing such conflicting reports about what kind of proposals are really being put on the table. Is it going to be partial? Is it going to be complete? certainly he must recognize the dire nature of the situation we're facing right now.
Look, I think President Trump does. I think he understands that it would be incredibly dangerous for Iran to have nuclear weapons. I mean, by the way, you don't have to go to that extreme. I mean, Iran doesn't have to use nuclear weapons to destroy America. Iran merely has to have nuclear weapons to blackmail America and to threaten America. And certainly, they don't have to drop a bomb on Tel Aviv. All they have to do is threaten to introduce tactical nukes into the battle space. And an American president will tell an Israeli prime minister, tell an IDF chief of staff, we don't care that October 7th just happened. Stand down, because we're not going to risk nuclear escalation in the Middle East. I think President Trump understands all of that. I think there's been a lot of confusion within the administration over recent couple of months about what should be the U.S. negotiating position. What terms should they dictate, as you alluded to earlier? And we have now at least gotten some clarity that the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, the Secretary of Defense, the lead negotiator, Steve Witkoff, are all aligned around the demand that Iran have zero enrichment and full dismantlement. And we've Congress has weighed in with 52 out of 53 Republican senators and 177 House members, GOP members, who have said the only acceptable deal, zero enrichment and full dismantlement. That's good, except now we're in a round of negotiations. I think it's the fifth round, sixth round, maybe coming up, where the proposal that the U.S. has given Iran is starting to step away from that. The current U.S. proposal is, and I don't get too in the weeds here on nuclear physics and sanctions relief, but essentially the proposal is, Iran, you can temporarily keep enriching above ground, not below ground anymore, but above ground. And you can do it temporarily, and we're going to build a enrichment facility which will be jointly owned by Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. That facility will be n not on Iranian soil. It will be producing n nuclear fuel rods, and those fuel rods can then be shipped to Iran, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, inserted into nuclear reactors, and then that can be used for electricity generation. So that's kind of the civilian nuclear program. But in the meantime, you can enrich. Now, the real question is at that point is, okay, well, how long is it going to take to build that thing? 3 to 4 years. Donald Trump's no longer president in January 2029. So if I'm Ali Khamenei, you just gave me the right to enrich, or not the right, but at least the capability to enrich, and this thing's only going to be built in 3 to 4 years, then I'm going to just wait till Trump is gone. By the way, I'm not sure anyone thinks that thing's ever going to get built. You could probably, Khamenei will come up with 10 excuses why, even if it is built, he's no longer going to be willing to stop enrichment and take reactors or take fuel rods for his reactor in 2029, 2030. And lo and behold, you've left them with the key capability they need to develop nuclear weapons. Right? Now, the Trump administration will say, yes, but we've gotten the capability from below ground, where it is right now, in places like Natanz and Fordo, buried under a mountain, 70 meters, heavily fortified by concrete. We got it up above ground, and we've done whatever they've done with the enrichment architecture and structure. That really matters. Is the full thing pulled out, or they just switch off the lights and say, you're not coming in here for a few years? But of course, when Trump is gone, they walk back in, switch back on the lights, turn on the centrifuges, and away they go. So it really matters what the U.S. offer was. My understanding is the U.S. offer was only 1 or 2 pages. So it's not like it goes into a lot of detail, and devil is in that detail. And there's a lot of open questions. But at this point, the Iranians have actually even rejected that. And so they are now preparing their counteroffer. I imagine their counteroffer will be either yes, but, or no, but, because they want to keep the negotiations continuing. They don't want Trump walking away from the table and using military force or authorizing the Israelis to use military force. They want to try to pull some sanctions relief from the Americans to stop their collapsing economy. And so they just want to trap us in endless negotiations while they salami slice us and ultimately get the kind of deal that they got out of the Obama administration, which allows them to retain their nuclear infrastructure.
So, another thing I don't understand, Why are they still in the nuclear non-proliferation agreement? What happens if they leave? I mean, I don't understand what their incentive is to stay in it when it seems to be their raison d'être to get nuclear power.
Well, I think as long as they stay within the NPT, they think that they can stay within the NPT and use the fiction that they're developing a civilian nuclear program while honoring their obligations under the NPT, in order to advance the program and position them so that at a time of their choosing, they can weaponize the program, right? What Khamenei worries about is that if he's caught with a nuclear weapons program, and he advances it to the point where it triggers a American and/or Israeli response, then the program gets bombed, and potentially the U.S. or Israeli military go after him and his regime and his leadership. And so the Iranians, again, they're chess players. I mentioned this. They play three-dimensional chess. I mean, they don't just like play checkers, move the pieces, and then boom, get caught. They're playing these pieces, and they'll sacrifice a pawn, they'll sacrifice a rook. But the two things that are most important to them are the queen, which is the nuclear program, and the king, which is the regime. And only if you hold the king hostage and say it's checkmate on the king, unless you give up the queen, your nuclear program, only when you really put the regime at risk will they make the kind of concessions on the nuclear program that can give us the assurances that they can't develop nuclear weapons. But without that threat to the regime, Khamenei will move the pieces, he'll sacrifice pawns, he'll sacrifice knights, and he'll play this game with us, and he'll play it patiently and strategically, and he's thinking three, four, five moves ahead. You know, they don't have elections every 4 years. No election cycle really in Iran. They have these false elections, these selections, but that's for the presidents who have no power. But the supreme leader, and this guy's been in power since 1989. Now he'll die soon, but when he dies, if he orchestrates the succession properly, there'll be another supreme leader and he'll be in power for another 30, 40 years. So they're not thinking 2 and 4 year cycles. They're thinking 20 and 40 year cycles. And the whole goal is nuclear weapons, not just one, but hundreds, missiles, not just long range, but ICBMs,
Right.
and restore the axis, rebuild Hezbollah, Hamas, these other proxies, and continue the march to destroying Israel, driving the United States out of the Middle East, and becoming the preeminent power in the Middle East and the preeminent Muslim power in the Muslim world.
There's that cloud again.
You got to think, if you're not thinking
Yeah.
like Khamenei, if you don't think
Sure.
like Khamenei and you think like an American or a Canadian or a European, you just you, and you and you and you mirror image, you think about ways in which, you know, these are our values. I'm sure they share our values, they share our priorities, then you're gonna just walk right into his traps.
Right.
You got to think like him all the time, and he is the most, I think, until recently, the most brilliant geopolitical strategist in the past 30, 40 years. And he's run circles around multiple US presidents. I think he's probably more brilliant than Putin, maybe on par with Xi. And October 7th was the moment where he made potentially a tragic mistake. And we've got to take advantage of that mistake. And not miss the moment and walk right back into the traps that he's currently setting for us.
Sure. So he's working on a much longer horizon. I mean, it seems like their plans are not even decades, but centuries in the making. They are very, very patient. But there's never been a more opportune or imperative time than this moment for Israel in hopefully with the help of the United States to attract to attack and destroy Iran's nuclear infrastructure. I mean, maybe you could help to inform me on like how long it will be before they replenish its air defense and missile production capabilities, but it's been like half a year. It seems like they're going to close in on that pretty quickly. Now, here's the problem. Trump is saying like to Israel, like not now, but at the same time, he's saying he wants the war to end quickly. And of course, as you mentioned, and as everybody knows, pressure is mounting from basically every country on earth for Israel to cease fire it just all around. So, how long does Israel really have before this window of opportunity closes for good, meaning pressure not to attack now and pressure to stop the war ASAP? It seems like a tiny, tiny window.
Yeah, so I think there are a few things that are happening. I mean, I think the pressure that's coming is really about Gaza. I mean, if you notice in Lebanon, there was a ceasefire, and under that ceasefire, the Lebanese armed forces are required to go and disarm Hezbollah, and so they are notified, either it's Israeli intelligence or local intelligence. They have a certain amount of time to do it. If they do it, great. If they don't do it, the IDF kills Hezbollah. There was just a massive bombing in Beirut, going after a drone factory. So the Lebanon example is a great example of this paradigm, right? You reach a ceasefire, the IDF is the greatest enforcement mechanism on earth. You're not going to rely on the French or the Brits or some UN body. It's like, go, there's Hezbollah, you got half an hour, take him out. Oh, you didn't? Boom. And as a result, actually, Israel's got under no pressure on Lebanon. Like, nobody's trying to impose sanctions on Israel because of Lebanon. Lebanon's a big success story for Israel. Judea and Samaria, by the way, I mean, 2 years ago, that was a disaster. I mean, there are terrorist attacks that were coming from Nablus and Jenin. It was complete chaos. Hamas was taking over. There were 23, 30 different terrorist organizations. IDF has been there every night, and they have reduced the threat of terrorism by, they say, 70, 80%, I think,
Wow.
according to a recent Shabak report. And I don't see like big headlines or news or pressure about Judea and Samaria, right? So good model, it's working well. The pressure from Israel or on Israel is about Gaza. Okay, so I just want to provide a little bit of sort of strategic clarity on the different fronts and the differences. The issue of Iran, that window closing, I think the reason the window is closing is because the Chinese, in particular, and to some extent the Russians, are helping Iran rebuild capabilities that Israel destroyed last October. And that includes the ballistic missile production capability, which was reduced by like 93%. They destroyed all of Iran's strategic air defenses, these S-300s that had been provided by Russia, but not all of its air defenses. A lot of air defenses left, including mobile defenses. But I think the Israeli Air Force showed its capabilities to really dominate the Iranian skies. But of course, that's all being rebuilt. And Iran is about trying to rebuild Hezbollah. More difficult because the Assad regime went down. The land bridge between Tehran and Beirut has been cut. We actually, believe it or not, have a Syrian government, anti-Iran, anti-Hezbollah, and actually being quite helpful in preventing that flow of weapons. But the Iranians are trying to find everything, flights into Beirut, other routes, or circumvention of restrictions and sanctions and everything that they possibly can to rebuild Hezbollah. So what the Israelis are saying is, look, we have a window. And at some point, those capabilities are going to be rebuilt. The axis of resistance, or axis of misery, as I call it, is going to be rebuilt. Ballistic missile production, rebuilt. Chinese are trying to send in these precursors. That like tons and tons of precursors that'll give Iran the ability to produce more ballistic missiles. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday on this, which was important to flag. And so that ballistic missile arsenal, which probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 3,000 ballistic missiles, the Iranians want to keep increasing that because that now, with Hezbollah effectively gone, that remains their retaliatory threat. That if they get hit, they're going to launch not hundreds, but maybe thousands of ballistic missiles at Israel that will overwhelm Israeli air defenses, and could lead to really massive destruction. And we got a taste of that in April and October of last year, where the United States and Israel and other countries were able to defeat that. But that may not happen next time. So that's why the Israelis are saying window is closing. President Trump, like, you put a deadline on the talks of 60 days. By the way, deadline expires next week. Are you going to keep talking? But of course, the Americans are going to keep talking because that's what Americans do. We just keep talking. And the Iranians are happy to make us keep talking because that gives them time to replenish their capabilities. They want to try to get past snapback. There's a very important moment in October where the ability to snap back the five UN Security Council resolutions expires. We can snap it back now unilaterally, that we don't have to get Russian and Chinese support. And that puts back all of the Security Council resolutions that were lifted as part of the JCPOA and establishes zero enrichment as the international standard, as well as imposing UN sanctions that I think would be pretty helpful in some important respects. So the Iranians want to play it out, get past October, and now the snapback has expired. This is the game. I worry again that, President Trump may be walking into this, but I'm hopeful that he understands their game and at some point is going to say, that's it. It's my final offer. I'm walking away from the table. And if you don't accept my deal, then the United States military or Israel or both are going to take out your program.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the existential threat is to Israel, not to US right now. And Israel has to do what Israel has to do. However, from what I understand, even if they have the bunker busters, they don't have the delivery mechanism without the assistance of the United States to go as deep underground as the Iranian nuclear infrastructure has been. But what about internal sabotage? I mean, Israel's done this before, and they could have plausible deniability. Iran never wants to admit it when Israel, blows something that strategic of theirs up. They always have, Iran always has an excuse, and they wind up being Israel's best cover because they don't want to admit their own vulnerability. I don't doubt that Israel has people on the inside of everything. Is that a possibility, the way that you see it?
Yeah, look, when it comes to Israeli plans, I would say that, I've often said that those who know don't say, and those who say don't know. Think that was wise advice before October 7th. That became increasingly wise advice after, as we discovered these incredible Israeli capabilities against Hezbollah that no one knew about except a small group of Israelis. And, when you talk about the walkie-talkies and then the pagers and ballistic missiles fired from fighter jets and some pretty impressive capabilities that the Israelis deployed to really both degrade severely Hezbollah and to wipe out Iran's air defense, strategic air defenses. We didn't know about those capabilities. So there may be capabilities that we and you and others don't know about and shouldn't know about. And those capabilities might be used in any kind of attack against Iran. I have no doubt that an attack would include some covert capabilities. Israel has demonstrated some remarkable ability to operate on Iranian soil, as you said. It's clear they've penetrated the highest echelons of the Iranian security establishment, the nuclear establishment. Look, there's things that they certainly can take out on the ground. I would be surprised if any kind of Israeli attack plan is only from the air. There's gonna, I would imagine that there would be Israeli special forces. I would imagine that there'd be Iranian agents who've been recruited by Mossad. I imagine a whole bunch of things that, but at the end of the day, it will have to include an aerial attack. And as you mentioned, Israel actually doesn't have the massive ordnance penetrators, the 30,000-pound bombs that can slice through concrete and mountains and destroy these enrichment facilities at Natanz and Fordow, or take out Isfahan. And this is what we have as the United States. And in order to have that, you need strategic bombers. And Israel doesn't have B-2s or B-52s or B-1s. There are, some ideas around this that I'm happy to share in general terms. But I think there's no doubt the United States can do much more damage. But one shouldn't have doubt that the Israelis have some tricks up their sleeves, where I think they could significantly set back the program. Whether they could permanently destroy it is an open question.
Okay, so let me ask, in all practicality, let's say that, I mean, it sounds like Iran already has enough nuclear material for nine bombs anyway. And let's assume that they drag their feet for long enough that they do achieve breakout. So, in all reality, up until like this point in history, okay, the nuclear club. Some people are welcome and some aren't welcome in this club. Has basically been limited to what would, at least on some level, be considered rational actors. I use that term loosely, but let's be honest, even Kim Jong-un has not been suicidal enough to use one yet. So, realistically speaking, if Iran does achieve nuclear breakout, would it be more likely that they would be using their nuclear power as a tool of deterrence or aggression?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always important not to dismiss the possibility that Iran would use nuclear weapons. So that this Islamic Republic, this regime, the particularly the people inside this regime who, you know, we talked about earlier, who imagine some Armageddon that'll usher in the hidden imam. We must never dismiss that possibility because I think it's really important to take what your enemies say seriously when they say they're going to destroy Israel. It may be through nuclear means. I mean, even this. The former president of Iran, Rafsanjani, who was considered, quote, a moderate, or at least a pragmatist, you know, he famously said that Israel is a one bomb country. We Muslims can afford to lose tens of millions because we have over 1.5 billion, and it would be worth it in order to destroy this cancerous tumor. That was the moderate Rafsanjani. Never mind what the hardliners were saying. So one must never dismiss that. Now, I do prefer to argue on grounds that the Iranians are not suicidal. They're homicidal, but not suicidal, and they don't want to have their regime destroyed. They know Israel is a nuclear weapons state. They know that there are probably nuclear weapons on Israeli soil or maybe on submarines off the coast of Iran, and there's no doubt that that country could also be destroyed. I worry that it And we talked about this earlier, is that nuclear weapons are not just for deterrence, but nuclear weapons are used as a way to supercharge Iran's conventional power and proxy power. And so, you know, once again, I'm going to use nuclear weapons as a way to blackmail the international community. I'm going to threaten like Putin has threatened, introduce tactical nukes into the battle space. I mean, when Putin threatened that, the Biden administration assessed there was a 50-50% chance that Putin was actually going to do it. And therefore, they refused to actually provide the Ukrainian military with the kind of long-range weapon systems that the Ukrainian military needed to hit Russian forces who were mobilizing on the Russian-Ukrainian border that the Ukrainians couldn't reach. So, you know, we forced the Ukrainians to fight the Russians with one hand tied behind their back. And they refused to give them that because we were afraid of nuclear escalation with Putin. Like that's Khamenei learns that lesson. He learns the lesson of Kim Jong-un, as we described. He understands that he can use nuclear weapons in order to constrain the ability of the United States and Israel to respond to conventional attack. And that is one reason we've got to keep an eye on his hands. The second reason is there's no doubt in my mind that if he has nuclear weapons, he will proliferate them. Right? One must remember that the Pakistanis developed a bomb. Aku Khan, who was the father of the Pakistani bomb, went off and created a nuclear proliferation network for profit. And he was the one who actually proliferated the designs for the centrifuges that the Iranians are currently using. And he proliferated that also to the North Koreans and the Libyans and elsewhere. So, you know, once a regime like Pakistan, which is an Islamist regime, or Iran, which is like an Islamist regime, gets hold of this key technology, it's only a matter of time before they begin to proliferate it. And by the way, they don't even have to proliferate it directly. Countries will respond to an Iranian nuclear program, an Iranian nuclear weapon, and certainly even to enrichment on Iranian soil by wanting to build their own programs. So the Saudis have made it very clear. If you give Iran enrichment capability, we want enrichment capability. If they build a bomb, we're going to build a bomb. The Emiratis, who, by the way, have a civilian nuclear program without enrichment and without plutonium reprocessing and adhere to what we call the gold standard, are going to say, well, wait a second, guys, we're a close ally, a responsible state of peace and prosperity. So we adhere to the gold standard, and The Islamic Republic gets the Iran standard. How's this fair? Like, what do you have to do? Be the leading state sponsor of terrorism and kill Americans in order to get a standard that we don't get by being a close ally? So, I mean, you start to see that a proliferation cascade occurs through the Middle East, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Turks, the Algerians, maybe the Egyptians. Now you have, maybe six, seven, eight more Middle Eastern states with the capability to develop nuclear weapon at a turn of the screw. And then by design or accident, you could see a nuclear conflagration in the Middle East. And not to be too American here, but our most important region in the Indo-Pacific, right? The Japanese, the Taiwanese, the South Koreans, the Philippines, I don't know, maybe the Singaporeans, maybe they decide, you know what? Why do we have to adhere to any kind of gold standard and not have nuclear capability? With a turn of the screw, we also want to have nuclear weapons because we fear the Chinese. And by the way, none of us trust the US anymore. You have no credibility. We don't trust your nuclear umbrella. Multiple US presidents, Democratic and Republican, have said Iran will never develop a nuclear weapon. Well, once they do, American credibility is shot. Everybody else is going to want to defend themselves. And now you have the proliferation of nuclear technology and potentially nuclear weapons throughout the entire world. That is an American reason why we need to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Always important to articulate that. We know what the Israeli reason is. There's no doubt about that. But it's super important in Washington to make the case why America needs to care about some country that's not 2,000 kilometers away, but is tens of thousands of kilometers away. That's why we need to stop them. That's the argument that we need to make to Americans and American policymakers.
Okay, so you've painted the landscape pretty clearly. So we have Iran and its proxies intent on destroying Israel. They're already in process of their grand plan, whether that is carried out or not, or whether they accomplish it or not. Of course, Russia has invaded Ukraine, is threatening Eastern Europe. China is biting at the bit to get at Taiwan. And of course, to go one toe deeper into this never-ending rabbit hole, as you already alluded to, China is not only Iran's largest trading partner and oil buyer, despite sanctions, but now they're selling them more material for, it looks like, about 800, 1,000 ballistic missiles. So, that's a mouthful. Do you think World War III has already begun?
I don't know if World War III has already begun. Cold War II has already begun. We're certainly facing this sort of axis of aggressors, China, Iran, Russia, North Korea. The axis, the members of the axis are partnering with each other. Some of the ways that you've referred to, I mean, the Iranians are selling drones to the Russians to kill Ukrainians. That the Chinese are selling precursors to make ballistic missile to the Iranians to kill Israelis. The Chinese are helping the Russians with military technology and sanctions busting. The North Koreans are sending soldiers to help the Russians kill Ukrainians. The Russians, the Chinese, and the Iranians are giving the North Koreans hard currency and key technology. When you start to see the lines of cooperation between members of the Axis, you start to understand that there are four rogue regimes working very closely together against the West. And I think the opportunity is quite profound because the weakest member of that Axis is the Islamic Republic of Iran, right? China is a multi-generational struggle against a nuclear-armed superpower. Russia is a perhaps multi-year struggle against a nuclear-armed power willing to throw hundreds of thousands of its own citizens into a grinding war in order to take over Ukraine and perhaps other parts of Europe. The North Koreans want to starve their own people and build literally a slave state in order to keep a grip on the North Koreans, threatening the South Koreans with their dream of unifying the Korean Peninsula, turning the entire Korea into a Stalinist dictatorship under the Kim family, threatening Japan, threatening the rest of Europe. These countries, and they have nuclear weapons and conventional weapons, and they can destroy Seoul in a week. Wow, those are three massive national security challenges for the United States. The weakest member, Iran. This week since the Iran-Iraq war. The tiny Israelis, 10 million people, small air force, small intelligence community. Boom, they've decimated, Hezbollah and Hamas, and the Shiite militias in Iraq are too afraid to take them on. And Assad has gone down, and the Syrian government is at least cooperating with the Israelis in some ways and tentative talks. And who knows, maybe Lebanon and Syria will be part of the Abraham Accords. That's not, outside the realm of possibility. Air defenses, ballistic missile production, all the reasons why Iran is so weak. What a moment. Like, double down on the pressure and hammer the Islamic Republic. And something we haven't even talked about, shame on me going this long, is providing, massive support to the Iranian people who have been on the
That was going to
street.
be my next question, literally.
I mean, I this was a passion of mine, and I speak about it a lot on my podcast. But the Iranians have been on the streets since 2009, yelling "Death to the dictator!" President Obama, Biden, Trump, are you with us or with the dictator? 2017, 18, 19, 20, 21. It's not just greed. It's not just middle class North Tehranis on the streets yelling, "Where's my vote?" after the fraudulent re-election of Ahmadinejad. It's blue collar workers on the streets saying, "Where's my paycheck?" They can't earn a living in Iran because of the ineptitude and corruption and yes, the sanctions that are on the regime. And then it's 2022, 2023, incredible Iranian women ripping off their hijabs, challenging a fundamental pillar of the Islamic Republic and yelling, "Stop the gender apartheid, death to the dictator. President Biden, are you with us? Or are you with the dictator?" Even today, there have been significant strikes across Iran, where truckers have gone on strike. Hundreds of thousands of truckers have walked off the job. This is it. We can't afford to be truckers anymore. Every time they're on the street, they get brutally repressed. I mean, the regime has done, egregious things, including, people don't even know this, but they launched chemical attacks against Iranian schoolgirls to break the back of woman life freedom. That is how brutal the regime is in putting down these protests. And yet, the Iranians keep coming back to the streets. Shame on us. Shame on us that we've done nothing to support these people. Rhetorically and emoting on X is no substitute for providing the kind of significant support they need, the kind of support Ronald Reagan gave to anti-Soviet dissidents under the Iron Curtain that helped bring down the Soviet Union. There is a playbook. It's called the Reagan Victory Strategy. It worked against the Soviets. Let's learn from that. And let's provide serious and significant support to the Iranians so that when they take to the streets, they got a fighting chance. Because our best chance of solving this problem is no nuclear deal. It's not necessarily Israeli or American military strikes against the nuclear facilities, all of which might be useful. Our best chance is to that 80% of Iranians despise this regime. They want to bring it down. They want to free Iran. They want peace with Israel. They want peace with the United States. They want the Cyrus Accords. They want to travel to America. Trump just put a travel ban on a whole host of countries, including Iran. Iranians love America. They want to come to our country. They're the amazing diaspora. You live in where? In
Los
Toronto?
Angeles.
We live in
I
Los
mean, I'm
Angeles.
in Los Angeles. We have a tremendous, I think the biggest one in America, the biggest Iranian Jewish community, particularly in Beverly Hills.
Right. So you grew up in Tarangelis. I grew up in Taranto. And so if you spend any time with Iranians, what you know is the only place in the world where Iranians don't succeed is inside the Islamic Republic of
That's
Iran.
right.
Okay. We can get into the details of the different Iranian communities and, the fissures and the fractures and the factions. That's a whole other conversation. The fact of the matter is they're very successful diaspora. They're incredibly successful people. The only place where they're not successful is inside the Islamic Republic because of this brutal regime. It just should show us that a free Iran, right, will be a prosperous and peaceful Iran. And that ultimately is the solution. Shame on us that we have not provided any kind of support for these brave people that are taking to the streets. So I believe that's changing in some important ways. I think the Israelis are waking up to that and starting to do some interesting things, not to be discussed on a public podcast. But, it's really important that our government in the United States understand that has to be that maximum pressure on the regime has to be married with maximum support for the people in order to have a comprehensive strategy create leverage, use that leverage, dictate terms, as you say, get a deal that strips Iran of its nuclear infrastructure. And if you don't get a deal that does so, then at least begin to take seriously the possibility of using military force, covert action, and all the other instruments of kinetic power. But support the people. Reagan understood that. I hope President Trump will wake up to that soon.
Amen. Mark, can you give me a few more minutes to talk a little bit more about the regime change question? Just a few couple two questions. Okay, you've been so generous. Thank you so much. And one thing I do want to stack on is that you mentioned that the Iranians are basically starving because of the general ineptitude of their government. But we have to also mention that the reason that these people lack basic energy, food, medicine, and even water is because the regime is exporting billions of dollars a year on terror. That is their priority, and their people are suffering as a result. Time is certainly ripe for a revolt, but I don't see them doing it unless they know that the Americans are behind them, because every time that they revolt, it's just brutally they're cut at the knees or worse. But let's say that a revolt does happen, that they get the support that they need, they do overthrow the regime. Do you see any world in which Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, the exiled son of the former Shah of Iran, who's been very vocal these days, comes back to rule Iran?
Yeah, so Reza Pahlavi, who I've had on my show, he was actually the first guest on the Iran breakdown when we kicked it off. I think he is a very eloquent person. I think he has a very large following inside Iran, because I think there are people of a certain generation and even the younger people who think about the time of the Shah of his father as a much better time. Than certainly they've experienced in 79. And I think for most people that was true. I think Pahlavi has made it clear that it's going to be a secular democracy. It's going to be up to Iranians to decide who their leaders are. And I think in some respects, I think maybe his vision is be a kind of a constitutional monarchy, maybe like the UK or the Netherlands that has a king or a queen. On some kind of constitutional monarch, but at the end of the day, it's going to be a democracy with a parliament and a prime minister and elections. And yes, I think it's conceivable. I mean, depending on if this happens, when it happens, I could see him being that constitutional monarch. But I think he's made it very clear, and Iranians, I think, who oppose the regime have made it clear this is going to be a secular democracy with free elections. We want to elect. They have experience, by the way. I mean, they have experience with elections dating back to the beginning of the 20th century. They actually do have experience with elections under the Islamic Republic. Those elections are rigged. They're
Right.
fraudulent. They're selections, not elections. But they do actually go out to vote, and I think they have had an experience of what it means to vote. And experience the frustration of knowing that at the end of the day, they're choosing between hardliners, hardliners, and hardliners.
Right.
But it does give them some sense of the experience of actually voting, which many of the people in the Arab world have never had an experience with that. So I think Pahlavi is a very important player in this. There are others. And the most important thing is you don't know their names, because if you knew their names, the regime would kill them.
You'd be dead. Yes. So let's say that that they're successful. Okay, the crown prince or similar comes back, returns to power or comes to power, creates a secular democracy. And knowing, well, let's say particularly the crown prince, but also what you're saying about the predominance of the Iranian people are friends of the West and even Israel. Do you think that it's going to be like ding dong, the witch is dead, Iran joins the family of man, the Cyrus Accords? But if that happened, would the whole proxy coalition follow? Is this a domino theory? What happens next?
Look, first of all, I want to be very careful about saying for sure the day after is Jeffersonian democracy and freedom and the Cyrus Accords, because We've got a bitter experience in the Middle East of day afters not looking so rosy. So, one has to be careful and cautious. One has to also engage in serious planning about what a day after looks like. I think Reza Pahlavi and many other people, Iranians, are engaged in that kind of discussion about what a day after looks like, so it doesn't end up looking like Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or all of these failures in the Middle East. I think that's why there are people who, when you utter the word regime change, all of a sudden their brains freeze and they think about, 500,000 mechanized US troops invading Iran, and they say, we're not going there. Now, of course, no one's talking about that. Everybody's talking about the Reagan approach of supporting the people, not invade. Reagan didn't send US troops to invade the Soviet Union. So it's important, the language, it's important how you conceptualize this. But yeah, if that were to happen, the axis of misery, does it disappear overnight? No. I mean, I think a number of these terrorist organizations, to some extent, are self-financing. Over the years, have taken military technology and innovated it, and now are more self-sufficient. They're going to get local support. They may get support from Sunni jihadist organizations. The Muslim Brotherhood may step into the void. The Turks may step into the void. I don't see that necessarily that they all die on the vine. I just think that they will be far less potent. If the Islamic Republic becomes the free state of Iran, and they will be, I'll have the revolutionary energy that comes out of Khamenei and the IRGC will be gone. And now they'll be left to fend, not by themselves, because they may have other supporters, but those supporters, particularly the Turks and the Qataris and others, they are highly problematic for their own reason. We can have another podcast on that, but they're not the Islamic Republic of Iran, right? They're not revolutionary in that sense, and they are not as destructive in their ambitions. So I think you'll end up with a much weaker proxy network than exists today. By the way, a proxy network that, thanks to Israeli military capabilities, is a lot weaker than it was on October 6th.
Silver lining.
In the cloud.
Okay. So to wrap this up, you have this brilliant Iran breakdown podcast, and I love the play on words of breakdown, which you've said both informs your audience and indulges your own appetite for greater understanding of Iran. What would you say is the biggest revelation that you've had to come out of that show?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, we've had, I think, 11 or 12 episodes. I selfishly created this because I really wanted to learn. I've been working on Iran for 22 years, and you start to think, wow, I know everything I need to know about Iran. And then you bring on these remarkable guests, and you interview them for an hour, and you realize, wow, I didn't know anything. I mean, this is really extraordinary. And we really cover the entire waterfront on issues, from proxies to nukes to missiles to drones. But I think my favorite part of the shows are bringing on Iranians and really talking about the Iranian people. I had a guest on recently. Her name is Liraz Charkhi. She's known to some people because she starred in the Apple series Tehran. She's a very well-known singer in Israel, who sings in Farsi and in Hebrew. She's Israeli-Iranian, parents originally from Iran. And she did this remarkable work that I learned about on the show, where she cut an album with Iranian female musicians who were inside Iran. And they did this sort of surreptitiously. And at some point, she managed to get them out of Iran to Istanbul. And then they performed together in a studio and they cut an album again. And then she took them on the road. And then they had all these shows. And the Iranian women had to cover their faces so they wouldn't be recognized by the regime. And they were, here's an Israeli actress and singer singing with these Iranian women. Her story was just beautiful. I mean, the bonding between these women, like the sisterhood of Israelis and Iranians. And then she managed to get a number of them out of the country, and they're living around the world. And so it was kind of a beautiful story. And kind of, it wasn't about nukes and drones and proxies and all the things we talked about on the show, which are all very important, but it was kind of that just human story of these remarkable women coming together. I think that's the most important thing I learned in the Iran breakdown, is that that's what matters. It's the spark of like human connection and human creativity, and love between these Iranian and Israeli women. And that ultimately is what defeats evil. And so, here's an idea for you, is yoga retreats with Iranian women and Israeli women. Bring them together, and the spark will bring down the evil.
Okay, last question. What does Am Yisrael Chai mean to you?
Well, Am Yisrael Chai is that at the end of the day, we are all a people. We are all a family. We will live. They will continue to try to kill us in every generation. But we will live. And what it really means to me is, and I've been in Israel many times since October 7th, is these incredibly like young Israelis who just, it's hard for me to talk about them without crying, just to who stood up, and incredible patriotism and courage, and they went to fight, and they fought for us. They fought for Am Yisrael, so that we can be, we can live. And to me, that inspires me every day. That's what gets me up every day. And I know, just to bring it full circle, like when those young Israelis meet the young Iranians who've been on the streets against the regime, that will be like a powerful life force that will transform the region.
It's absolutely beautiful. Mark, thank you so much, not just for joining me, but for being so incredibly generous with your time and, of course, with your knowledge. This has been just an amazing learning experience for me. And I can't, it sort of makes me feel better. Other parts are like, but I like going into this feeling a lot more informed as I watch these talks and negotiations unfold. So thank you so much. And Am Yisrael Chai.
Bye, and Shabbat Shalom.
And Shabbat Shalom. You beat me to it.